Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey America, I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper, a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter. And you're about to experience the wild game domain from the hunt to the hearth, airing live on Heritage Radio Network. I'm joined for today's show by my co-host, the brains of the operation, of course, Jesse Riley.
How are you doing today?
What's going on, Jesse?
Good.
And we're lucky enough today to have a very special guest, my friend from Scotland, Caroline J. Wilson. Welcome aboard, Caroline.
Hi, how are you?
I should say welcome to the domain. Something like that. Do you hear that? It sounds like we're in a wind tunnel.
It does. It's because of the lovely air conditioning.
Oh, it's so cool. I love it.
It's like 97 degrees outside.
Yeah. We are recording today's show from the Great Plains of the United States of America on a very windy day. Or from the top of a cliff at Yellowstone National Park as I try to snipe wolves with my Remington 700.
And duck eagles.
Yes. Kill them all. As long as you eat them, it's okay. So, welcome back. What are we talking about today? It's funny because Caroline is a student at the Institute of Culinary Education. She's studying in the baking and pastry program. Brilliant student, by the way. And doing a great job. And I was chatting with her, and I was saying something sarcastic or funny or mean or whatever I normally do. And she said, "Don't talk to me. I know about hunting. In Scotland, I know all about hunting."
And okay, so now you have to tell us, how accurate is this accent?
No, it's terrible. I know, but it's better. It's better than it's been. I do a pretty good French, but not a good British, Scottish kind of thing going on. Yeah. But with all kidding aside, we started chit-chatting, and she grew up or kind of worked her way through hunting lodges throughout Scotland, and I thought, there we go. There's my next guest. This will be brilliant because we've done shows in the past where we talked about European hunting traditions.
French hunting traditions.
Yeah, focused on
differences.
France.
So it'd be really interesting to know, like, if you could talk about, like, how it is in Scotland and how you kind of got started, where you were working, and the things you observed and did when you were there.
Okay. Well, I basically started cooking lodges because it was the best way to make money in the summer. During university and after school. Mm-hmm. And you just go out for a week and you cook breakfast, lunch and dinner for all the people going shooting for a whole week. And it would go from Sunday to Sunday because you're not allowed to shoot on a Sunday or fish on a Sunday.
You're not allowed?
No.
Okay.
Hmm. And basically you just have estates all over Scotland. Some are huge and some are probably about the tenth of a size. Like, they can be anything from 800 acres upwards.
So you said estates. Specifically for hunting or game sports, shooting, and or no?
Some are, I mean, the majority of them are farms, working farms, and then on top of that, they'll have gamekeepers to look after all the birds, like the grouse and the pheasant, and then you've got all the deer, the roe deer and the red deer, which are looked after by a commission, but then you, on your estate, look after the ones that stay on your estate.
Huh.
And how large are these estates generally?
They're from about 800 acres upwards,
wow.
I'd say.
That's more than the 48 acres I'm going to be hunting on this year. But
yeah.
No, so I want to go back to this for a second because I really want to understand this estate thing. Because when we did the show about France, which was started as about Europe, and you know, this idea of the monarchy and where England, you know, where Europe was with the kings, queens, and all that business, and you know, how they basically had a right to the animals, where the commoners had no right to the animals. And you kind of, that's still kind of reflected in the hunting as far as it being a gentleman's sport and the respect for, I guess, the other hunters and how Europeans approach. Is it the same in Scotland? Because here, I mean, it's more of the average Joe, I think, going out hunting.
Yeah, in Scotland, I think probably like 100 years ago on the estates, if you owned the estate, you'd have shooting and hunting parties where you'd invite your friends, and they'd all be like gentlemen, lords, ladies, and they'd come up, and then you'd have your gamekeepers that have been looking after your estate, and then all the farmers and hands that work on the estate would then do all the work, like being the beaters and the drivers for the shoots.
See, that's interesting, because we were talking about that too, Jesse. Like, I don't know, you know, as far as the techniques or the methods used, you just said the beaters and what do you call them?
Drivers.
Yeah, so you see a lot of that for all animals? Is that just birds, deer? Talk a little bit about the strategies used on these estates?
For birds, you have like walked or driven shoots. So if you're walking, you walk in a line and you're walking as the birds coming up, mm-hmm. and then you shoot them, but you've got numbers. So you start at one and go down. And driven shoots, you've got the beaters who are, say, like in the woods in front of you, scaring the birds to come towards you and go up.
See?
And you stand still, whereas you don't walk.
Now, so it's a very organized activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not dissimilar to bird hunts here. Mm-hmm. Now, I was going to ask you about dogs. Do you see a lot of dogs used in Scotland for bird hunting? Because here, that's a proud tradition.
They're used to collect the birds. So you'll have your dogs by you while you're shooting, and then if you shot them, they'll be sent off.
Yeah. Ah, very cool. See, now here we have obviously both, sometimes mm-hmm. combinations. The dogs could do both. They could flush the birds for us, locate them. We have pointers, we have flush dogs, and we also have retrievers, where and depending on the bird, my dog's a retriever, a golden retriever. He retrieves the ducks. He's strictly retrieving. He couldn't find a duck unless it was dead in the water, So that's interesting, and that probably evolved here from, obviously, Europe.
Right, our traditions come from there.
Obviously.
So I think dogs probably are used, but mm-hmm. most, if you're a guest on a shoot, you don't really let your dog, in case it goes a little bit mental.
Right.
Scares the birds. You don't know what it's going to do.
Of course. Can't trust a dog.
No.
You had a question, Jess?
So when people do a deer hunt, how is that different?
Deer hunting, you go off with like a small, maybe like five of you would mm-hmm. go off with with the head, like gamekeeper mm-hmm. or a couple of others, depending how many is in, staying to go off. If you go in a small group, you'll try and track the deer. When you can see them, you'll follow them for a little bit, and then the group will break off. So, like, three people may stay and two will go, and there'll be one shooter. And you literally will then just crawl through the mud and all the heather to fight and just sit and wait, and it could take up to, like, 3 or 4 hours. Sometimes it'll take 8 or 9, depending on the season. Because at the beginning of the season, they're really high up, and they're quite hard, but mm-hmm. closer to October, they come further down the hill, so they're a lot closer, and sometimes you can probably shoot them up when you're having breakfast through the window.
So, wow. Yeah, I mean, well, that's not, I mean, it's kind
not
of
not that dissimilar.
Like, yeah, it's not really. I mean, we have stalk hunts where you mm-hmm. go out and stalk the animals. But my question, what about seasonality? Would you know that, when they come into season? Do you guys have it on these estates? They're privately owned. Can they hunt all year? No. And that's restricted through the government?
Yes.
You called it the commission, I think?
Yeah, I think in different... For fishing, certainly, different rivers close different weeks. I mean, it's all roughly at the same time, but there may be a 1 or 2 week difference.
Right.
Shooting, there are very specific dates for deer, roe deer, and all the birds. So August the 12th is the biggest bird shooting day, because it's the first day you can shoot grouse.
Huh.
And so it's the biggest day of the season.
See, that's funny, and I'm trying to think why mm-hmm. August. I'm assuming it's warm, and but see, because here are deer specifically. I mean, it's all everything's based on their mating schedules. So, depending on the animal, either A, we try to avoid their mating schedules, to leave them alone so they can mate, or we try to take advantage of their mating schedules, you know, when they're mm-hmm. in rut. So they're stupid, crazy, thinking about other things, running around, and I can shoot them with a bow and arrow. So that's interesting.
They're distracted.
They're distracted. They have other things on their mind, and then they fall into my trap, as I call it. Okay, so if I want to go to Scotland,
yeah,
and I show up, and I'm like, hey, I want to hunt. I pay?
Yeah.
Will they let a foreigner hunt?
Yep, you can do anything. All you need is a license for a gun, if you're taking your own gun.
Right. So let's say I take my rifle, I ship it over, I follow all the rules.
Yeah.
There's special permits and no.
No, you don't need a license or a permit to hunt. You just need a license for the gun.
Very.
That's because you're hunting within a party. You're not out on your own.
Yeah, you're on a private estate.
Which, can you hunt on your own? Could I go there and do a, say, is there public land?
No.
No. See, that goes back yeah. to, mm-hmm. you know, the king and queen. So that's very interesting. So you'd have to arrange a hunt if you're going over to Scotland through a outfitter, as we call yeah. them here, an estate,
yeah.
and arrange your hunts. Now, what about bag limits as far as how many animals you can take, shoot? Is that controlled by the estate or the government?
Deer, stags is the government. So somebody will go to the estates at the beginning, like before shooting season, and they'll assess how many are there. And then they'll tell you how many stags you can take. And then they'll work that out for the amount of people coming to shoot through the season.
And there's no record kept of it, though? Like, here we have a tag system where they give me a tag, and then I got to give the tag. I got to put it on the animal, and it's got to...
No.
No, so it's...
They record everything, but not with tags.
Got it. I'm trying to think how we yeah. could...
No, they have books. They
cheat.
Just log it. Oh, and they people do cheat. Yeah.
See, I want to cheat.
They look back to the year before and go, oh, we only got 4 last year. Let's say we had
to. Brilliant.
We're and only so going to get 4 this year.
All right, make sure we use pencil when we write it in the book because we may change it. All right, listen, I'm loving this. We're going to come right back. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with the Wild Game Domain.
You're listening to Favorite Flower by Pamela Royal on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from the Wild Game Domain. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Hey, welcome back. I'm your host, Chad Pagano. I'm here with my co-host, Jesse Riley, and a very special guest today, Caroline J. What does J stand for?
Jane.
Jane, of course. Stupid-ass question. Jane. Wilson, sorry. I lost it there. I got all mixed up with the Jane. Jesse, you had a brilliant question.
So we were talking about, before the break, talking about hunting on an estate. So does that mean then, could we then assume that there's no sort of like public lands, or if you're in a remote rural area that you see a deer, you could shoot them?
You could, but it'd be illegal.
Love it.
Loads of people do it, though.
Really?
Yeah.
Based like, on the sport or the food?
Like, no, probably doing it for the food.
Because they're mm-hmm. down and out, and
yeah.
they kind of need to feed their family? Country
no, not,
folk?
No, I used to work in a pub in the country. We used to go lamping rabbits at night so we could make rabbit stew to sell.
There you go.
Okay.
I've heard that, and that I've heard stories out of Ireland where a lot of the pubs arrange hunts, I guess, and they bring all the deer back or whatever they're hunting, and they use it for food at the pub, which I love.
Yeah.
And that would be illegal, though. Is it kind of something like where it's illegal, but, you know, unless you're really stupid about it, we're not going to come and arrest you?
Yeah, but we did get chased by the farmer once.
Yeah. That's cool, though.
And then the head chef broke his leg.
During the chase?
Yeah.
Nice. Sorry, you're down. Did you, like, step on him and run away? That's what I would have done. I'd be like, sorry, you're out. Take the fall. Okay, so, Jesse, you had that brilliant question.
Oh, so
about
then,
the process.
Right, so now after you're on the hunt, and let's say you get some feathered friend, right? And you've got all the support staff. What happens when they come back to the lodge?
They'll come back, and they'll put them in braces, which is two pairs. Mm-hmm. And then they count them for the day of how many you've shot. And then depending on the estate and what they want to do with them, they will may keep a certain amount. Like, if you're shooting on the Harrods estate, that's you know the big shop in London, Harrods?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So the guy that owns that has a big estate in Scotland. So on the 12th of August, the first day of the grouse season, he'll have all of them helicopters straight down to Harrods to sell. So some of them will go for sale to wholesalers.
So that's really interesting. And that you can sell.
Yeah. Wild game.
Wild game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here, that's illegal.
And then some of it will be given to the shoot party to take home with them. So you might get a couple of braces to take home. But most of it goes... You get it in the restaurants still with the pellets in it.
Wow. So the estate's basically making money, because I'm assuming when I go to hunt there, they're going to charge me.
Yes, they will.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then they're going to take my game and sell it to an establishment of some sort, right, to make money there. It's actually brilliant.
Yep.
Now, what if I say to them, hey, I really want to keep that stag deer or, you know, my venison, or is that a possibility, or it just isn't the way they do it?
It's not really the way they do it, but you probably can buy it from them. You get to keep the head.
Right. So it's a trophy hunt.
Yeah.
Fine. Yep. But I could say, you know, I'd have to pay extra for the meat.
Some people, yeah, you probably have to pay extra for the meat. And nowadays, some of the lodges as well have got big smoke houses, so you can get your venison smoked or the fish that you catch smoked, and then it'll get sent to you later on.
See, that's really interesting because here, first of all, it's illegal to hunt, to sell.
Right, you can trade.
You
can
trade.
I can gift you the meat.
Right. Yeah. We could give each other meat all day, but I can't sell it to you.
Yeah.
And you certainly couldn't sell meat to a commercial establishment, wild game to a commercial establishment.
Yeah. And I think actually if you ask many people, they'll tell you that they're concerned or afraid about the diseases that wild game may have.
Right, which is asinine, but I get that. I mean, and hopefully, maybe that's part of the reason we do it here, but basically it started here because we decimated the wild game populations here in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s.
Late we were down to
nothing, We were down to absolutely nothing. There wasn't a buffalo, there wasn't a deer. We had slaughtered every turkey on this continent, and we realized, holy crap, if we don't start controlling this, we're not going to have any wild game.
Now let me ask you, because here, talking about how we've, through over-hunting and also pollution, decimated, let's say, our salmon. Because we used to have salmon runs in New York and Connecticut, New Jersey. So we stock that. You know, we stock lakes with juveniles. Do you have anything like that in Scotland?
No, I don't think so. I think some places will have salmon farms when they'll breed them to... They do a bit.
Big aquaculture business.
Yeah.
Right.
But the majority, I mean, the biggest rule with salmon fishing now is that you can catch and take out the first one on your first time on that river, but everything else has to go back. You can't keep it.
Wow.
You can take as much brown trout, and you have to take out the sea trout if there are any, because they've got the lice that kill the salmon. But apart from that, it has to go back.
Wow.
Catch and release. Ugh. That's a bad, bad word for me. Bad phrase for me.
So now at the lodge, if you have game, did you prepare that game at the lodge, or did the chefs prepare that game?
I think the people will take the salmon back, because generally fishers don't want to eat fish when they're fishing all day. It's really weird. So you like you do a menu plan and you arrange with them before you go, because sometimes you're in the middle of nowhere and you can't get to a shop, so you have to take everything up for the whole week,
right,
and fill freezers and stuff, and so you agree with what they're going to eat, and fishers never want to eat fish.
Really?
Yeah.
Now what kind of food are they eating? I mean, are they eating game or no?
Yeah, they'll eat birds and stuff around August, September time. They'll have venison, that's about it, game wise and the rest of the time it's like beef. Everybody loves beef.
So and with the fowl, do they, so then there's a facility there and people who are charged with like hanging the birds? And
in the more expensive lodges they do, and then in the cheaper lodges you just get given it fully like fired up, at which point I throw it back at the boys that have shot it and told them to sort it out themselves.
See, that part fascinates me. Mm-hmm. That I could go and not eat the food that I shot.
Because to me, fishing, the most joy is like pan-frying it right when you take it out of the water on a little fire.
So as an example, even in Canada, I've hunted in Canada. We were at a lodge, an outfitter, and we went out hunting. First day out, and they had these all-terrain vehicles. So they'd load us up, and we were stand hunting. So they would say, okay, there's your stand. They drop everyone off, and at the end of the day, they drive back down the road, and you'd wait out on the road. It's dark, and they pick mm-hmm. you up. So as we were driving back, we were pretty close to where we were staying, and there was a big open field, and there had to be – I didn't see a deer all day, but as we were driving back in this field, there had to be 100 deer all in this field. So the guy stopped the vehicle, and one of the guides stood up and he grabbed someone's rifle, and we were like, what are you doing? It's dark, you know. And he goes, I'm getting dinner. And he was this French guy in a French accent, and so I see him, and he's picking out the deer through the scope, you know. And I'm looking, because I'm curious, there's some big deer out there in the field, and I'm like, wow, all mm-hmm. right, he's gonna take a big one, right? And I'm looking, all of a sudden deer start scattering everywhere. And I jump off with him, and we walk out into the field to go find the deer. And I couldn't tell which one he hit. Mm-hmm. And we stumble on this deer. It was probably freaking 80, 45 pounds. It mm-hmm. was the smallest of does. And I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, it's tender.
Yes.
We went back, and within, I don't know, an hour and a half, we were mm-hmm. drinking bourbon and eating venison at the lodge. And it was some of the best venison I ever had, so... to me, that would be a little funny about the hunting, you know, not eating the actual game that you're hunting.
So, because you're from Scotland, we have to ask you about haggis.
Here it is.
It's amazing.
I was kidding. I wasn't even gonna, I was afraid. I didn't want to, you know, but yeah.
It's very important, haggis.
It's very important.
It's very important.
So, do you have to have the ceremonial knife?
Only on Burns Night.
Okay.
Now, alright, so it's very important. I find that interesting. Okay, why?
Because you toast the haggis with one of his poems, which is written to the haggis.
And that's why we do this?
Yeah.
Who knew? I just thought it was done out of necessity.
No. Because it gets walked in with a bagpiper on a big plate.
Okay.
And it's toasted, and then they cut it open.
Toasted. After it's boiled.
No, as in toasted, as
in
cheers.
Hey.
Cheers.
I was like, toasted.
Not color or Maillard reaction.
I thought it was boiled. I see. Toasted. Mike, that's fun kind of toast.
Yeah, with whiskey.
And in honor of?
Robert Burns.
For?
He's a poet.
Yeah, but because he...
wrote a poem about...
haggis.
Yeah.
But do you only have it on that night, or you have it at other times of the year?
You can have it whenever you like, but Scottish, traditionally, you have a big... Burns Night supper in January and eat a lot of haggis and drink a lot of whiskey.
So are there, I'm just curious, like good and bad versions of haggis?
Yes. Bad versions.
So what would one look for if you were looking for a good version of haggis?
Probably one made by hand by a butcher in Scotland.
That's good.
As in not like a mass produced, buy one in a supermarket.
Ew.
Go to a proper Scottish butcher.
So they sell them in the supermarket?
Yeah.
Like frozen?
No.
No.
There's like a company called McSween's.
Oh, it's like Smithfield.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
I hope you're not a sponsor. If you are, I'm sorry.
And big ones.
Wow. And people do that.
Yeah, but they're not so bad. The McSween haggis is not bad, but you can get better ones.
Right. And there's a real craft to it. I mean, yeah. The seasoning.
It takes days.
It's food. Yeah.
My friend made one once. He said it took him like 3 days to do it. Once you cook down all the different types of offal, and then I think it's quite tricky getting it into the stomach lining and keeping it, you know, without bursting out. And
yeah, now how is that done? Do you guys know? I don't know. Like the so you get this stomach lining. Is it stitched closed?
Well,
let's
open it both ends. Right.
Yeah. Nowadays they metal clip it.
Metal clip it.
Yeah.
So we stuff it. We metal clip it.
Yeah.
Boil it.
Yeah.
Now, is it a standard size? Because I got to imagine the stomachs we're using are different, right? I mean, do we look for a standard size haggis?
Well, the majority of them now are about that size. Mm-hmm.
So she's showing something about the size of a football, pineapple, kind of.
Pineapple.
Yeah,
cantaloupe.
But
yeah.
Oblong.
Yeah.
Now, I was talking to Caroline earlier, and I'd read somewhere, someone had told me that they'd been to Scotland. And they had gone to some of the, I guess they were at some of the touristy areas, you know, the tourist traps. So they had gone to some restaurants and they had ordered haggis. And they were like, oh my God, I don't know what everyone's complaining about. It's so delicious. It's good. It's so appetizing. It smells good. And to later learn that there's this new movement, or maybe it's been going on forever, for tourists, like when they order haggis or you offer haggis at certain places, they stuff it with lamb, ground lamb, and beef, and
so it's not
pretty
accessible. It's not chock full of organ meats,
right? So they
it's
avoid organ meat.
Tourist haggis.
Yeah, which sounds good to me.
The Mick haggis.
Yeah, it's probably the sort of haggis we got given at school lunches,
which was
pretty disgusting.
Oh my God!
It didn't even come in his stomach lining. It was disgusting.
All I'm thinking about is my kids whining about their school. I'd be like, you better shut up. You're lucky you're not in Scotland. You'd be eating haggis right now.
Exactly. And lumpy neeps and tatties.
Oh. I love it. I got to go there and try it. I hate to say this, but unfortunately, right, we're out of time.
I know. We've ripped through another half hour.
Time flies. Yeah. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us. This has been awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. Jesse? Thank you, as always.
Oh, thank you, Chad.
I really appreciate it. I'd like to thank my producer for engineering today's show. And you could always find the archived episodes of The Wild Game Domain, From the Hunt to the Hearth, on heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.